サンマーサンブダサナモタサバガワトアラハトサンマーサンブダサナモタサバガワトアラハトサンマーサンブダサブダンダンマンサンハンナマサミ。Being a teacher involves many things, including teaching how to turn on a microphone. So, for that and many other things, much gratitude. Nice to be back here at the Angela Center. Again, for our Thanksgiving retreat. Some new faces who haven't been to this retreat before. Nice to see. Definitely missing a few of the old faces that didn't get to come this time for some reason. Keeping them in mind. And many, many people who have been here before. A few years older, maybe. A few more gray hairs, a few less hairs, a few more pounds. But sort of a kind of a continuity, but with all the aspects of bits of change that come through the years. We were all talking about how nice it is to also be with a group of people who get settled so quickly on a retreat. Doesn't happen in a lot of retreats. I thought that maybe I'd just spend a little bit of time, a few minutes, going a little bit more into one of the contemplations that Lungpa introduced the other day with the Satipatthana, specifically the third Satipatthana, contemplation of mind, of citta. Maybe just to go into that a little bit more. Because it's this path of purification of citta that is really the essential core of the Buddha's teachings. And I think it bears a little bit of exploration. And as I talk about it, or as I reflect on it, there's an assumption that pretty much I make for myself. And I think the teachings really go into the contemplation of citta with sort of an assumption of a standpoint of right view, a point in right view that isn't always accepted as Dhamma teachings have come to the West. So I just put that out there, that the teachings on rebirth are something that I kind of assume as a basic understanding or basic part of right view as we talk about citta and purification and liberation of citta, just because it makes a lot of sense. And there's probably some folks here who may not hold that, I guess, really a sense of faith or belief in the process of rebirth. You know, folks who don't see it as necessary, or as maybe kind of have sort of the agnostic view of we don't know, since we don't experience it ourselves directly, so therefore it's not something to really consider. And then there may be others who are more, you know, well, such as myself, we admit that we don't have firsthand knowledge of rebirth, but it, take it as such, as a working hypothesis, Because to me it makes just a whole lot of sense, and B, it's in the teachings, pervasively in the teachings. The Buddha refers to it over and over again in many different ways, in many different in places, aspects of karma and rebirth. And I don't have any reason to believe that the Buddha would teach that just as an effective tool to get people's attention based on the culture he was living in at the time. You know, he has more integrity than that, I think. So I take it, you know, somewhat on faith from the fact that it's pervasive in the teachings, and somewhat on the fact that it just makes a whole lot of sense, and also as a working hypothesis, it actually provides a lot of motivation for sticking to the practice over the long term. I think without that kind of sense of appreciation or acceptance of karma and rebirth, I probably wouldn't have much motivation other than to enjoy life as best I could, take as many drugs as I could to keep the suffering to a minimum, and then quietly make my exit. I've often thought that if I could somehow convince myself to be an annihilationist, then I would, because at least there's a very clear ending to suffering. But unfortunately, I can't quite believe that. So here we are. So that I just say that as kind of a prelude to talking about citta. When Ajahn Jeff was up at the Hermitage, I was up at the Pacific Hermitage in Washington State for this past Vasa. Just got back two weeks ago from having been there for 4.5 months. And Ajahn Jeff came up about a month or so ago and visited us for just an afternoon and gave a talk that evening. One of the monks there asked him the question, you know, if he could provide a little bit more clarification from the canon on definition, essentially, of citta versus mano, which people may understand that word as referring to some aspects of the mind as well, intellect more specifically, functional aspects of problem solving and categorizing and thinking and analyzing, things like that, and also vijnana, consciousness, and kind of how he saw from the suttas that those three interrelated, or how they were defined. And it was surprising to me that he said basically that within the suttas themselves, that actually the Buddha didn't really go into a lot of detail in defining citta per se, that most of how we use the term, or how accomplished practitioners, translators, scholars, define the term is mostly from inference on how it's used in the teachings, rather than the Buddha actually saying, this is what citta is. So in some ways it's fairly, it's just based on inference from the teachings as best we can. Lung Pa was talking about that a bit the other day or night when that question arose with, you know, the difference between heart and mind, and that citta is much more of a broad, inclusive term. So it's a bit, you know, shaky ground to kind of actually define it in a way. But the way that I've heard it described from other teachers that kind of makes the most sense to me in terms of a working definition would be that it's more, first of all, to really understand it more as a process rather than any kind of thing, is really this fundamental, basic process of cognizing experience. I think as Ajahn Suchito explains it or talks about it, it's the fundamental attribute of citta, the fundamental attribute of this cognizing process is awareness. Awareness, citta is tends to be have qualities of a receptive kind of a process, a sensitivity, receiving input from all of the different ways that experience can come to us through the body, through the mind, through all of the sense doors as consciousness operates. All of this data, all of this experience is something that moves through this cognizing, or that the cognizing apprehends in a way, or just registers through this basic attribute characteristic of awareness. Sometimes the awareness is clear, but most of the time the awareness or the citta is also can be cloudy and confused, depending on all of the underlying tendencies that are existent within this cognizing kind of process. It's often described as mirror-like, so that whatever objects of experience are coming through this cognizing process through citta, if they're attended to, if these objects are attended to through the lens of greed, hatred, delusion, confusion, attachment, then the citta will kind of assume the same color as the objects that are being attended to or sought after or held onto or grasped, clung to. So it's a sensitive, receptive, and changeable kind of experience. So for better or for worse, whatever the mind is attending to and moving towards as the object, those objects come through, then the citta takes on that tone, that color, and in that sense is reflective. Sometimes the objects that are picked up and attended to are wholesome objects, objects that lead in the direction of peace and liberation. Other times the objects that are grasped onto are unwholesome, leading to confusion, suffering. And the citta takes on those same qualities, so sometimes it's referred to as being able to discern whether the citta is kusala citta, whether the tone is wholesome and moving in a direction towards peace and the end of suffering, or whether it's akusala citta, unwholesome citta. So it just depends on how the mind is holding, how the defilements of mind, how the underlying tendencies are grasping, holding on to what comes through this process of awareness. The citta, this process of ongoing cognizing awareness, is also that which can be liberated from all suffering. And that's what the Dhamma teachings are pointing us towards. There's a nice simile that the Buddha uses that helps describe this process of when we decide we want to work more towards the ending of suffering rather than the creation of suffering. He describes a process that's similar to what a goldsmith does in terms of refining gold, the process of refining gold. In that the goldsmith will start with a mixture of gold dust or gold fragments, a mixture of those with stones and dirt, lots of different kinds of grit that comes in from the gold miner. And the first process is that where the goldsmith will just start to sort through that and pull out all of the rocks, the coarse dirt, as part of the process of refining, starting to remove those very large objects that are mixed with the gold. And then after he's done that, he's left with a mixture of gold dust and things like coarse sand and dirt. And so the first process of washing happens there, where the mixture is washed with water, rinsed, and the coarse dirt, coarse sand, and other aspects that are contaminating the gold will be washed out. And then the next step is this mixture of fine dirt and dust, still mixed with the gold dust. So the goldsmith will rinse it again, wash it with more water, rinse off the fine sand, the fine dust, and then is left with just gold, really. But the gold still has a bit of what's called dross, tainted. It's not completely purified yet. There's what's called the dross in the gold. So at that point, the goldsmith takes it and heats it up in a crucible and starts to melt it down. And as that process happens, this dross, this fine black substance, very fine stuff mixed with the gold, will start to burn off. And then the what's left in the crucible after that is gold that's really quite pure, but still stiff and not very workable. And so the goldsmith will heat it up again keep on heating it, getting it to just the right temperature. Sometimes he has to add more fuel to the fire to get it hotter. Sometimes he has to add a little bit of water to the mixture to cool it down, but tending to it in just the right way to get it to just the right temperature where the gold then becomes much more workable and malleable and flexible. And at that point, he is then able to mold it into anything that he wants to, into whatever jewelry or ornament he's going to make. At that point, it's workable. So the Buddha says that the purification of citta is similar to this process of gold purification. So we have been born into this life as human beings, and we come with this body and this mind, and most of us have arrived with a fair amount of rocks and coarse dirt in our body-mind complex. But for some reason, we've also arrived here with an inclination to see if we can do a little better. You know, we might say that it's the result of causes and conditions, past life, karma, coming to fruition, that we've been born in this very precious human rebirth. it's a pretty rare kind of situation to, at least in the Buddhist cosmology, to be born as a human being with all the other options that are available for rebirth. The human birth is quite rare. And not only to be born as a human being, but to be born with enough good karma to have all the requisites that we need. We're living in a fairly, an extremely abundant time. We have more than enough material requisites for our well-being and our comfort. So that's an added aspect of the precious human rebirth. And then further, we have the fortune to have a motivation from whatever source to explore deeper. We have the health and the faculties, the sense faculties intact to be able to do that. And we have the teachings available as well. The dispensation of this Buddha has been going on for more than 2,500 years. And we have been fortunate enough to be born in a place and in a time where we can access that. So for reasons, causes, and conditions that we've put in place, possibly over many, many lifetimes, we are here again at the Angela Center with our bodies and minds and our rocks and our dirt. How many times we've done this, I don't know. Uncountable, maybe. Angela Centers of the past and future to come. But we should take advantage of it. So we've got a chance, and most of us, I think, are motivated, for whatever reasons in our lives, to start working on this purification process, or continue working on it. And the first step with that same analogy of getting rid of our rocks and our coarse dirt is the layer of precepts. Because at its most noticeable level, the obstructions, the confusion, the craziness in our minds will manifest in our outside actions, in our bodily actions, and in our speech in particular. And this first layer of working towards helping to settle that down and find some peace is by picking up certain standards of how we act and how we speak. And this, as everybody knows, is where the precepts come in. So, you know, many, if not most of you, probably follow the five precepts in your daily life. Certainly all of us here today are following at least the eight precepts. The five precepts somewhat modified and added to for a bit more renunciation and simplicity. And that forms the basis for the purification of citta, the settling down, the refinement of this awareness. And that is the way to move on to, form the foundation for moving on to the next step. So having removed the kind of coarser actions of body and speech that result in a lot of suffering, where we, you know, might harm other people or other creatures or take advantage of them or speak in ways that are painful or hurtful, we make a very strong resolution, very strong determination to at least if our minds are still real crazy, at least we try not to inflict it so much on other people. And just that in itself not only provides a huge amount of safety and goodness for the outside world, but it starts to settle and purify the own mind, one's own mind, because then when one has taken on those precepts, even if it's just for a few days here, say at this retreat, then you can start to see just the natural ease of mind that comes from that. A lack of regret over what it was that I said or what it was that I did that was unskillful or harmful. That in itself is an incredibly strong purifying tactic. So as the mind starts to settle from having restrained bodily action and verbal action, then we start to move a little bit into more looking at the mind, the level of mind. And kind of the second stage, one could say, in relation to this analogy, where there's still coarse sand, coarse dirt, is a process where there's still thoughts, even though our bodily and verbal actions have been contained, the thoughts maybe still occasionally run into areas of sensuality, ill will, and thoughts of harming. And the process at this time of washing the mind, washing the citta, is starting to let go of those and to establish the alternatives of simplicity, of kindness, non-ill will, of non-harming, compassion, to establish those as intentions in the mind, if nothing else, to realize the value of those, to pick them up and to hold them out as how we want to start moving the inclination of the mind. So we pick up practices, like, say, on this retreat of really simplifying things, the renunciate precepts that you've taken on, or in the monastic life, taking it on more full-time. We take on practices like developing thoughts of loving-kindness, consideration for others, compassion, understanding the suffering of ourselves, of others, really reflecting on those, reflecting on the commonality of our experience as human beings, all sentient beings, and the wish for ease, the wish for peace. We bring that into active contemplation so that our the interior aspects of our experience start to transform little bit by little bit. We see the peace that comes with simplifying our lives too, making do with less than we think we might need, asking ourselves, you know, when can we can simplify our lives? What's the result of that? What's the result of letting go of all of the involvement in ways that we don't need to with the material world? So we start to train the mind, establishing right intention. Then the mind will start to settle down a little bit more. We're left, though. We come maybe to a meditation retreat, or we start to pick up meditation with these preparations, and we sit down, and the mind is still pretty active. The mind, the thoughts are coming and going. Maybe they... maybe they aren't quite so involved in previous thoughts of acquisition or sensuality or anger or those kinds of things, but they're still ongoing memories of daily life obligations, family, friends, work situations, reputation, those kinds of things will start to emerge from the mind. And we find ourselves having a hard time settling down. These thoughts, just more mundane thoughts, but definitely active thoughts will keep coursing through, and it captures our attention, and we find that we're lost in these over and over again. And this process of refining is partly recognizing, just bringing that bare mindfulness into the process of citta, just really noticing, developing that sense of mindfulness and clear comprehension. So it's taking the knowing of the citta and turning it into more of a clear knowing, and really looking at it just as it is, starting to notice the underlying affective qualities that are supporting these the way that our attention is distracted in the mind. So there's this top layer of thoughts and memories and plans that's all kind of coursing on, sometimes on a very verbal level in the mind. But there's also this underlying mood or affect that's kind of feeding it, that's going on underneath that layer of verbal activity. And this is where we start to look a deeper layer to what's supporting that activity, to what's feeding it, and start to tune into that qualitative aspect of experience. Lungpa has been talking about that, you know, in terms of the hindrances or the awakening factors, or ways of softening, gladdening the mind, the different contemplations. So this is the next step in refining. We take these kind of worldly thoughts, memories, and activities, and try and substitute them with thoughts of Dhamma. We're still using the process, as he was describing this morning, of vitakka, vichara. We pick up an object, we pick up a theme, something that we can even contemplate a bit, pick it up, establish it, and use it to move into a bit more deeper layer of refinement of the citta. So rather than just being lost in worldly memories and concerns and projections and plans for the future, we steer the mind towards qualities that will help settle, that will help clarify, make more clear the mind, supportive of developing gladness and tranquility, the qualities of rapture and pleasure that he was mentioning, and all of those aspects that are good things to develop, ways of establishing kusala citta, wholesome states of mind that are part of the path of liberation. So we've gone through the rinsing process again, rinsing, trying to rinse out some of the more worldly thoughts, and what we're left with are these thoughts of Dhamma, thoughts of how to apply and soften, gladden, moisten the mind a little bit. And those are very skillful things to spend time with, to establish in the citta, in that purification. But there's still room to go there. The next process would be where we start to let go of even those skillful, wholesome states. We start to heat up the mind a little bit, the process, or cool it down, if you will, start to with that basis of gladness and contentment and pleasure in the mind from a very refined reflection. That serves as a basis for really clearing the space to move into that unification of mind with objects such as the breathing or that object that we've taken up for contemplation and for really settling, stilling, and quieting, developing a tranquility, a very joyous, alert, but very peaceful, calm, tranquil state of mind that's leading towards what we call samma samadhi, right collectedness, right concentration, that is kind of equivalent to that refinement in the gold process, where we are now, we've still got a fair amount, it's pretty much all gold, the dross is burned off. But still, even with these very pure, peaceful, concentrated states of mind, there's still some brittleness, because it's dependent on a certain concentration, a certain layer of conditions that hold that together. So then we apply a bit more heat, or a bit more cooling, if you will, again, and continue the refinement process to the end, where the gold is completely malleable and workable, where the mind is free from brittleness, and the purification process is complete. So this is the process of moving towards the liberation of the mind. The tendencies, the underlying tendencies, greed, hatred, delusion, are seen through. Not only have we created a very peaceful state of mind, but the underlying tendencies that lie dormant in there are starting to be seen through insight in this process of purification, and starting to be released. So it's a gradual process, and it goes in fits and starts, and sometimes it seems like we often have, I think, tendencies to measure our progress, and we get excited when we experience a certain level of peace and calm, and then disappointment comes when some more dirt finds its way into it, or maybe even a few boulders manifest itself back in our experience, and then we regroup. We have to realize that there's going to be a lot of back and forth and up and down as the purification process goes on. Sometimes it's not quite so linear as the story would make it out to be. And just realizing that that's part of the practice, that's part of the life, and that's why I think having a long-term perspective is really important, because there will be the ups and the downs, the good days and the bad days. Maybe everybody had a couple of bad days getting started, and today's a good day, and you think, clear sailing from now on. Well, that's a dangerous thought. encourage people to practice with being present for what it is right here and right now, and to reflect on different strategies that seem to have borne fruit, and other strategies that seem to have ended up in the wrong direction, and to use that, but not to attach to the successes, in quotes, or be disappointed with the what we might call failures or mistakes, but just to see it all as part of the refining process, the process of gradually moving over time, over many lifetimes, towards a very gradually growing contentment, understanding, development of insight, wisdom, and then realizing that at some point, if that process is attended to, nurtured, continued, and not given up on, then at some point it must bear fruit. So I think I'll just leave that for today's contemplation, and people can continue to practice today.